You know, you cannot keep the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, I believe, without considering at some point the fruits of the Spirit. When we spend time eating the unleavened bread of sincerity and fruit, sincerity and truth, that fruit makes a strange bread. Although I will say, in Barbados, one of their biggest desserts or biggest breads was banana bread. So I guess you can make some pretty good bread out of fruit. You can make bread out of fruit, but you can't make fruit out of bread. Okay. But when we eat that unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, we do see the fruits of God's Spirit begin to emerge, and we begin to change in life, and we have these wonderful traits of conversion begin to manifest themselves through what Galatians 5 calls the fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, and so on. You ever think about the fruits of the other spirit? Because in that same chapter, in that same section, there are some other descriptors. They are not called fruits of a spirit, but they're called works of the flesh. But they are indeed fruits of a certain type of spirit. They are the end result. They're the growth of a certain type of spirit that's at work. And when anyone succumbs to that spiritual influence, they start becoming like the father of that spirit. Just like when we incorporate the fruits of God's Spirit, we become like God. We know the father of that spirit of the flesh as Satan the devil. Well, how would you describe Satan? What's the first thing that comes to mind? Jesus described him in various ways: a liar from the beginning, or a murderer from the beginning, the father of lies, a thief who comes only to steal and to kill and destroy. What is it that he aims to steal? What is he trying to destroy? How does he go about doing it? We could probably come up with a long list of the fruits of his spirit. But what is sometimes less obvious to us are his tactics. We see the end result very clearly, but we don't always see the tactics that he uses. I've given a lot of thought to this lately, especially after hearing someone make a statement, a descriptive statement not long ago, that seemed to be very insightful. They made the observation that Satan never attacks from the front when he can attack from the rear. Satan never attacks from the front when he can attack from the rear. He is never overt when he can be covert. You see this in life so much. It's so true. Like I said, I've been thinking about that, not only because of hearing that, but in light of examining and preparation for the Passover, thinking about this at length. And as you read about the history of the Passover, the events of the Passover itself, just before Christ died, as you go back to look at Israel coming out of Egypt, and as you look at our existence today, you see this tactic powerfully at work. Satan used it from the very beginning. He used it to constantly be a thorn in Christ's side, and he uses it today. This subject is easy to take off on and pound the Bible with and speak against. Most of us have been victims of it, and I don't have to give a sermon to convince anybody that it's wrong. So why speak about it? Well, because it's the beast that will never die. It just never dies. It's always there. We are often victims, as I said. Sometimes we're perpetrators. It's just there. It is also something that seems to be increasingly common and just pervasive in the world around us. It has become part of the culture in which we live, and we are swimming upstream about it, against it all the time. What do you think it might be? What is that tactic? We would agree intellectually that we scorn it. However, whenever it occurs, it's not an intellectual event. What I mean by that is that it's not something we think about. It's not something we ever plan. It usually happens out of carelessness. It happens when we're really not thinking. It happens when we allow things to sort of bubble up and come spilling out without control. And sometimes we catch ourselves, and it's usually embarrassing. But a lot of times we don't catch ourselves, and it can just be there. We can even be blind to it. So I'm very aware of its presence in my own life and in our lives. It's just there. It always has been. So I come today to speak, to simply appeal to our spiritual reasoning, to appeal to our spiritual discernment that God gives us, that helps us focus our thinking on a higher spiritual plane so we can deliberate in a very careful way in order to control our thoughts and actions and to guard against this tactic and really to protect one another. So what is this tactic? One of the statements describing Satan is where we find this particular tactic and the way we see that he works. This is a verse that probably raises a lot of questions. You can read this verse and think, well, how does this actually take place? How often does it take place? When does it take place? And where? And what actually goes on when this occurs? It's found in Revelation chapter 12. In Revelation 12 and verse 9, we read about the great dragon. Revelation 12, 9, the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. And then notice, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. That certainly stirs a lot of questions. It stirs a lot of observation. I just noticed this morning for the first time, I think I've sort of carelessly quoted this over the years and always said the accuser of the brethren. You know, you can be talking about in casual conversation the accuser of the brethren. It doesn't say the accuser of the brethren. It says the accuser of our brethren. The accuser of our brethren. All of a sudden, that makes it personal. This is our family. All the brethren, this is our family. That should immediately raise some degree of defensiveness in us. That, hey, there is an adversary who is accusing our family before God day and night. This is a description of what he is, and it is also a description of a tactic. And one of the central themes of the Bible from the beginning to the end is that the devil is the enemy of all humanity. And he's always out there waging war against human beings in every way possible. The very name Satan means malicious intent. That's what it conveys. The Hebrew noun literally is adversary. Somebody takes an adversarial position. The verb forms of the noun are translated accuse or slander or be an adversary. That's what he is. Now, there are other places in the Bible that also call him the devil. And the word devil is also revealing. It comes from the Greek word diabolos. We get words like diabolical and diabolic from it, which describes something very sinister or wicked. So this is a very revealing statement here. As you think about it, though, you begin to realize he doesn't just accuse the brethren, our brethren. The very first accusation that you find in the Bible, back in the book of Genesis, his first accusation was against God. He's also an accuser of our God. He came privately to Eve, and the first thing he did was contradict what God had told her, and he told her a lie. The serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. Now, that was a lie, but it wasn't an accusation. What followed was the accusation, when he followed up with that, making a statement about God's motives. Then he told her the motive. He interjected something, and he said, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. That's Genesis 3. So the lie was, you're not going to die. Then the accusation. Well, the accusation was also a lie, but it took a little different form. It was an accusation against God. Which do you think was the most damaging to Eve and her relationship with God? Was it the lie or was it the accusation? Well, in a sense, the lie set up a conflict between two opposing ideas. One, you can live forever, and the other one, no, you won't. But the accusation set up a conflict between Eve and God. It set up a conflict between them because it imputed that God has something that's going to involve you right now. There's something going on that he's not telling you. And it became something that would affect their relationship. You'll notice something else that's very interesting. He went to Eve about God. In Revelation 10, he goes to God about the brethren. Both cases tell us something. It's Satan going to one party about another party. Going to one party about another party and making accusations, either accusing God of something to Eve or accusing the brethren of something to God. We begin to see something at work there. We begin to see a spirit. There's a spirit at work in Satan. And Eve did not recognize that spirit. Now, she could have stopped him at first and she said, oh, wait a minute, you're telling me this, he's telling me that. I'm going to investigate and get to the bottom of whether we die or not. I'll get back to you on the facts here. But she didn't stop there. And she then did not discern something at when he came at her then. He said, well, you know, here's what God is. God's doing this. God has this motive. The accusation, she did not stop and say, you know, I'll get back to you about the other thing, but wait a minute. You are coming at me. You're accusing God of something. And I don't like the tone of your voice. I don't like the tone of this accusation. She did not discern the accusative spirit. She never saw that. Never saw it coming. A third of the angels apparently didn't see it coming. And they got sucked in by this being. Now, Satan, you put accusation in the hands of some being like him who is intelligent, passionate, articulate, self-serving, with something to gain, and he can influence. This is why perhaps God's law is so strong against false accusation. Someone came up to me this morning after services and said, you know, I was thinking about that. In Proverbs where it says there are six things the Lord hates and seven are an abomination, he said two out of those are a lying tongue, and then a false accuser, false accusations. And then the other one is he that sows discord. And he said, boy, they're all connected, aren't they? There is such strong emphasis. And you see strong emphasis in God's law about false accusation. But you know what? You also find some strong statements in the Word about the spirit of accusation, even when it's not false. Even when something is true, there's a very strong statement about that in a number of places. But one of those examples is when the woman was taken in adultery. Now, it was true. She committed adultery. She was guilty. Jesus knew she had sinned, but he also saw something about the approach of those who were dealing with her. They were not coming to her saying, you know, here's a problem, ma'am. Let's talk this through. We have to get some help for you. We have to confront this. We have to help you overcome this. No, he saw there are two problems here. One was the fact that she had sinned, and the other was the accusative spirit that her, what did he call them? Woman, where are your accusers? Not where are your counselors? Where are those who are helping you through this trial? Where are those who are trying to help you get back on the right path? Where are your accusers? Because he saw what was driving some of them was they simply wanted to get her. They were out to get her, and it was very destructive. Jesus hated that spirit of accusation. He had been a victim of it himself. His people were going to become victims of it. And he understood what happens. It perverts righteousness. It perverts right thinking. God chastens people that he loves. He has to point out our problems. And the Bible is very clear. Sometimes we see people's problems. You know, you stay close to people, you see things. But there's a line that is crossed when somebody goes into the spirit of accusation. And that's something we have to be very discerning of, have very discerning hearts. So Revelation 12:10 is very revealing when it makes the statement, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before God day and night. You think, wow, what is going on? Satan knows who the saints are. He knows they are saints in God's sight. He knows God is on their side. He knows Christ gave his life for them. Christ is their advocate. But there he is. He's just always tirelessly throwing it up before God. Always pushing this accusation. Putting these things up to God. Sometimes you wonder, you think, does Satan really think he can still win this thing? Is he deluded enough that he thinks, if I can just keep bringing this up, maybe I can get to God and put a wedge between him and his people? It certainly shows the malice of the devil toward all of humanity and toward the church. But it also shows his tactic, his cunning. What it does not tell us here in Revelation 12:10, though, something we have to consider, is that the accuser of our brethren will also accuse them before our brethren. It's not just that he accuses before God. He also accuses before others. He will always strive to get people thinking in that way. And if he can pull people into that mindset of becoming accusative, get into that same thinking and same behavior, someday he can bring a really good accusation before God. One of the best accusations he could bring before God is, see there? They're thinking my way. They think my way, not yours. Watch, look what they're doing. Look what they're doing, God. What a stinging accusation. This is one of his devices, brethren. It's very clever, it's very deceptive, and very destructive. This verse tells us that Satan appears before God as an adversary to the church, constantly bringing indictments, constantly bringing accusations. Now, does that mean they're true or they're false? He probably has plenty of true stuff. Probably has no shortage of true stuff. He could keep a running list. Have you ever personalized that verse, verse 10? Have you ever looked at verse 10, the accuser of the brethren, and say, I wonder what he says about me? What has Satan ever said about me? What has he brought up? What charges? I could probably, real easy, give me 5 seconds, I can come up with a list of things that he can say, that he could bring to God and say, you see that? You see that? You see that? And what does God say? What does God say about us? You know, it's an intriguing verse. Some commentaries say the language here denotes a legal setting. That the word implies, the way it's worded, implies formal charges being brought before the highest court. And that the accuser is like a prosecutor. That's an interesting observation, because 1 John talks about our relationship with Christ, with God, and says that Christ is our advocate. It's almost that Christ is the defender for us. And that is our relationship that we have with God. We have our own personal relationship with God, and we often think about the things that we're working on, that we're trying to overcome, and our relationship directly with God and with Jesus Christ. But sometimes maybe we don't comprehend that there's Satan also watching with our lives and seeing what's going on and accusing, trying to take those same things that we're working with God on to try to overcome, and he's using it to try to drive wedges. He's using it to try to destroy us. So this is very interesting in verse 10 about what goes on between Satan and God as it relates to us. But here's another question. What goes on here on the earth? What happens here on the earth? Does Satan do the same thing here where he accuses people before, not just before God, but before other people, where he tries to stir us to do the same thing? Can he get us to do the same thing that he does? That's an easy question to answer. We can answer it like this. How many of us can think of situations right now where people have been hurt due to accusations? Is that hard? We've all been victims of that. And we've all been perpetrators as well. The Bible doesn't let us off very easily. Ecclesiastes 7:20 says, there is not a just man upon earth that does good and sins not. Also, take no heed to all the words that are spoken, lest you hear your servant curse you. And then it says, for oftentimes also your own heart knows that you yourself likewise have cursed others. It's a common human condition that sometimes we lose that control. And when that happens, it doesn't come from God. It comes from Satan, who's trying to pull us toward a certain mentality. It's easy to do. But let's contrast this, though, to some other spirit beings, the servants of God called the angels. Let's go to Jude, verse 9. We find an interesting statement in verse 9 of Jude. An interesting situation, too, we don't know much about. And that was a dispute over the body of Moses. It's very curious. We don't know much about it, but that's not the main point I want to bring up. This is in the context of a very strong letter, short but strong. But I just want to focus on this one verse to bring out something about the angelic tactics. Verse 9, "Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" It says he did not dare bring a reviling accusation. Why? Was Michael afraid of Satan? Was he a sensitive archangel who didn't want to step on Satan's feelings and offend him? Was it because, you know, really deep down inside, Satan's just a good guy who went wrong, and maybe if he could talk to him nicely, he could bring him back around? No. If anyone deserves a railing accusation, it would be Satan. The Bible's clear on that. Barnes's commentary makes an interesting statement. It says, "He did not dare to do it because he feared the Lord, or because in any circumstances it would be wrong. Though he could have given harder words or severer language in which the other deserved, he chose not to do it, and he would not do it. He dared not to go that way." Why would it be wrong to bring a railing accusation against Satan? Well, it has nothing to do with whether or not the devil deserves it, because the Bible is very clear what the devil is. Rather, brethren, I think it has to do because of what the effect might have been on Michael. What would the effect have been on Michael? When we start playing the accusation game, it's a spirit we can get caught up in. It's a spirit that takes us down a wrong road, a bitterness. We lose judgment. We become more susceptible to anger. We lose control, and we play into Satan's hands, and Michael was not going to play that game. Michael could deal with the facts. Whatever the dispute was over Moses' body, Michael could look at this and say, "Your conduct is wrong, but look, the Lord rebuke you. I'm not going to get into this accusation game." It's not good. Michael had already seen, through long history with the angelic world and with the human world, where that goes. He was not going to get into the reviling accusation game. It would play into his hands. And so he simply said, "The Lord rebuke you," which means restrain or command. The same word is used when Jesus rebuked the wind and the sea. He just restrained it. Same word is used when it says he rebuked the demons that were afflicting people. And he says, "God can take care of this. God will take care of it. I will not get into a railing attitude." It's very similar language to 2 Peter chapter 2. A few pages back, 2 Peter 2. Beginning in verse 9, "Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. And especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. They are presumptuous, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. Whereas angels, who are greater in power and might, do not bring a reviling accusation against them before the Lord." Isn't it interesting? Satan brings these types of accusations about human beings before the Lord, but the angels do not go down that path. They don't work that way. They don't even go there, even though they are superior in might and power. What do? They simply call upon the Lord to rebuke them. They state matters as they are. They have, this is the way they handle things. Calm, seriously, direct, but not giving in to a spirit of accusation. They don't want to carry that, and so they won't go there. Now, if these superior angels, those who are greater in power and might, if they dare not, in the presence of God the Judge, speak evil, even of bad angels, what are we to learn from this? It's sort of obvious. That's why it's so terrible when it happens between people, and it has happened. Numbers 12, you can read the story of Aaron and Miriam, what they did with Moses. They took something that was factually correct, but turned it into an accusation, dredged something up. And there's a statement there where God says, "Were you not afraid to speak evil of my servant Moses?" But the answer was, it was a rhetorical question, because no, they hadn't been afraid. Something had happened. Did that spirit come from God? Well, of course not. Moses was their brother, literally their brother of the flesh. But it was pointing out that it was more dangerous to them than it was to Moses, because it takes them down the same road as the accuser of the brethren. It's more dangerous to them, but you can be sure it hurt Moses too. It was a hurtful thing. So it's easy for humans to go where angels fear to tread. You can just sense a caution among the angels with this. And it probably has to do with the lessons that they learned from seeing Satan at work when he deceived a third of the angels, from seeing the way that he manipulated human beings. They've seen it. We can see another great example of it in the story of Job. You're familiar with that. You may be less familiar with a similar statement made in Zechariah, similar to what is stated in Job. You know, there's a time when Satan came to God, and God said, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan, just immediately, he launches in. Does Job serve you for nothing? You built a hedge around him. You bless him. You take that away, and he'll curse you. He was accusing Job that you are a shallow, shallow man. You are a shallow Christian. You just have a thin veneer of Christianity, and you're only in it for a certain thing. Take it away. We'll see what you're made of. You know the story. It's almost though that's Satan's natural way to think. That's the way he comes at everything. Resents, criticizes, looking for flaws. It's an interesting statement in Zechariah 3, though, in this prophecy of Joshua. Zechariah 3. Here's another account, less famous perhaps than Job, but it just illustrates the presence of Satan. He showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and look who else was there. And Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" And the Lord was defending Joshua, because it says Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and was standing before the angel. All of us have stood before God in filthy garments before, at some point or another, and we've all been cleaned. That was one of the things we thought about at the Passover, thought deeply about. Then he answered and spoke to those who stood before him, saying, "Take away the filthy garments from him." And to him he said, "See, I have removed your iniquity from you, and I will clothe you with rich robes." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head, and they put the clothes on him, and the angel of the Eternal stood by. Then the angel of the Eternal admonished Joshua, saying, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, if you will walk in my ways, and if you will keep my commandments, then you shall also judge my house, and likewise have charge of my courts. I will give you places to walk among those who stand here." We heard that at the end of the Bible study. And this is another theme of the Bible that's throughout, that God is holding out to us this opportunity to be in his family and to rule in his kingdom. and to set up a totally different environment that will have none of this accusative spirit in the world tomorrow. But we have to walk in His ways and keep His commandments and judge properly before we can judge His house. Always knowing, though, that Satan is standing there waiting to oppose. And this is one of the ways that he does it. So whether it was Job throwing it up to God, saying, you know, look, this guy is a sham, or whether you look at the broader perspective and say, you know, this isn't, Job is only one person, but it's happened for millennia. It's happened over and over again to the people of God. Not only does Job do it directly, but he tries to influence others too. In Job's story, you read about Job's three friends. Eventually, they concluded some things about Job that just were not true. They reasoned it out, came to conclusions, even accused him. One of his friends said, the reason you're going through this is because, you know, you've blown it, Job. You're this and you're that. Sort of heaped it on when he was down. What are they called? His miserable comforters? That wasn't from God, but they came to be that way. And you and I have been judged and accused before too. You know what charges have been brought to you or brought before God about you? Your accuser is always there. He's always writing it down. He is always catching every error. Do something wrong, and boy, he's on it. And he's just ready to be an expert witness. Just ready to stand before God and say, there he is again. There she is. There she goes. See? And he'll slander to do it. That is his name. He rails on us before God and before each other. And sometimes he has very legitimate evidence to put on the table. If we were there, if we heard it, there are probably some things he accuses us of. We could just, what would we do? We just hang our head and say, I'm guilty. I'm guilty. And God knows that. That's why it's important for us to not get caught in that frame of mind, even when we see issues, even when we see things with our brothers or our sisters. We have to guard against the spirit of accusation. Let's notice Ephesians chapter 4, something very interesting said here. Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 25, therefore put away lying, each one speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. This too was one of the great themes of the Passover. We are all blood brothers. It's through the blood of Christ that we've become brothers and sisters, but we are all members of one another. Then he says, be angry. There are things to get angry at, but he said, do not sin. Be angry and do not sin. Now, this is a sermon for another day because there is a lot in that. What does it mean to be angry and not sin? Spiritual anger management. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. And then verse 27 says something very interesting. Nor give place to the devil. The margin says, do not give an opportunity to the devil. Times of anger are dangerous times because it opens the door for potentially an easy path for Satan to take, to come in. It opens a place for the devil. That's why there's so much from God about how to deal properly with one another. Satan is not a peacemaker. To make it even more powerful, the impact, let me show you how strongly this is worded in another place that normally, certainly doesn't carry the impact that it does in the original language. In Titus chapter 2, Paul is instructing Titus as a pastor and telling him how to instruct different groups of people and what to instruct them about. He addresses older men and older women and younger men and younger women. And it's easy to read over one of these verses and not get the real impact of how it would have been understood by Titus and anybody reading this earlier. Titus 2, verse 3. The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. Now the word slanderers is the focal word. In some the translations, it's accusers or false accusers. What is interesting is the Greek word here. The Greek word is diabolos. You remember that a few minutes back? Diabolos is also translated what? 34 times in the New Testament, diabolos is translated devil. Devil. If you do some word studies on it, you will find very quickly that the feminine form of this word is literally a she-devil. A she-devil. Whoa, all of a sudden, I don't know about you, but that's a more powerful word than a slanderer. Do not be a she-devil. Wow. That's what it says. It makes a direct connection to Satan. Slandering, accusing, makes a direct connection to Satan. It's also interesting, the word diabolos, if you break it down, it's comprised of a combination of two words, dia meaning through, and balo meaning throw. It literally means to throw through, or to throw between. And this too pictures what the devil does. Satan threw lies at Eve. He threw accusations at Eve. He tries to throw things through. With Eve, he created a schism between her and God. And you know what that eventually led to. He tries to throw between. Throw things between relationships through the spirit of accusation. Now, one commentary makes a statement about why Paul worded it this way. It's a very powerful statement. It's a generalized statement, but it probably carries a degree of truth. One commentary says this, just as men are more inclined to abuse people physically, women are more inclined to abuse others verbally, which can be even more destructive. Now, men don't take any pleasure in that, because it's not that anybody's immune. He was just talking about tendencies. General tendencies, but specifically, anybody can do this. It can be a he-devil too. You know, it's not just she-devils, it can be a he-devil. But what it means is that a person allows Satan to work in this way. We become a vehicle for Satan working. When you read things like this, it just really gets our attention. The point is very simple. It's not of God. It's very destructive. Let me give you a few things to think about, to take home from here. I'm just going to throw these out very quickly. You'll have to take it home and meditate and study and put some flesh on these bones. But here's some fundamental things. How does accusation affect you and me? How does it affect us? Well, number one, it reduces our ability to love people. It reduces our ability to love people. Now, an accusation, if it's false, can be a literal breaking of the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness. That can take place in any number of ways. If something is completely wrong, that's a little more easy. That's just plain wrong. But there can be accusations of things that are just plain wrong. Or if something is partially true and partially untrue, it can still be a false witness. Something can be 90% right, but if it's 10% wrong and we include that 10% wrong, that's false. It makes the witness false. Something can be incomplete. We may have truth, but we may not have all the truth. We may be lacking important parts of the picture. We may make certain judgments, make certain statements. And if it's incomplete, they can be false. It can be a false accusation. Not knowing all the facts, but drawing conclusions could be very wrong. There's another type of accusation that also reduces our ability to love people. And that is when the subject is completely true. There may be something that is absolutely 100% completely true. But the accusation can be very damaging. The command says not to bear false witness. Is it okay to always bear true witness? Is it okay to say, well, it's true, therefore I can say it to whomever, whenever I want to? No, not that either. There are plenty of statements in the Bible about that as well. Is a spirit of accusation okay as long as it's true? No. No. Even truth has to be guarded carefully. Romans 13:8 says, "Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loves another has fulfilled the law." Then he lists several of the commandments, and he said, if there's any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this statement, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love works no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. You see, love asks a lot of questions when it's contemplating saying something. Love asks, is this true? How do I know it's true? Do I have all the truth? Just because someone says it and they're my good friend, does that mean it's true? Love asks, even if it's true, is it fair? Is it fair to say something about this person without the person there? To defend himself or herself? Would I want that done to me? Love asks, what is the need to know? Is it necessary to say this? What is my need to say it? What is the need of the person to hear it? Could this possibly hurt somebody who hears the accusation if they don't need to hear it? Just those criteria alone, love would eliminate a tremendous amount of hurt. A second reason of how the spirit of accusation affects us is that it inhibits the work of God in us. The work of God in us is maybe defined in a number of ways, but one of the things at the top of the list would be, by this all men will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. The work of God in us is to build a unified, loving body. That's an example of how to live our lives. To glorify God and Jesus Christ by our actions. Accusation can destroy that. That leads to the third point. I'll show you something here. You all have one. You could hold up yours too. This is my little finger. You probably recognize him. I have another one too. They're twins. They're born on the same day, you know. They're friends. They do a lot of things together. They play together. They work together. They're not joined at the hip, but I mean, they just do a lot together all the time. And they have other close friends. They have other fingers that are close friends. They have a hand that's close friend and arms. In fact, they're connected in some way with this whole body. And this one out here on this end is connected to this other one. And they're just members of my body. They're parts of my body. Now, this little finger here is just sort of doing nothing right now, but my other little finger, where did he go? Well, right now, with some of his other friends, he's wrapped around an object. And he has a degree of control over this object. And that control is sort of a complex thing because he's in it with some other friends. And it's controlled by thinking. And this other little, not this one, but my other little piggy, my other little pinky, he's about to do something really dumb. This one's taking a rest here. And this one is about to put something into action. Come on, Michelle, you worked with me. I know I'm pretty dumb at times, but... Now, you know, if I would have smacked my finger, if I'd have just let the hammer down, so to speak, if I would have smacked my finger, that would have sent shockwaves throughout my entire body. My mouth probably would have been saying some things, maybe good or bad, or just noise. The other hand would have probably thrown this up in the air. My feet would be dancing. My eyes would be watering. The entire body would be affected if I would have pounded my finger. If I would have done that, it would have had a terrible effect. And a blow that would only take a fraction of a second to inflict could take weeks to recover from. I might have to have it put in a cast. You know, It would have caused damage that would take weeks to recover from it. Now, I don't have to explain the illustration. We are all interconnected. Now, if I would have said, hey, Mr. Evans, George, would you come up here? I can't do this. If I would have asked you, George, would you come up here and just give it a good whack? Would you have done it? No. No way. No way. No one would. No one would come up here and whack my little finger with this hammer. So why do we do it with words? Why do we do it with this hammer? This one, though. The most dangerous tool in our toolbox. Far more dangerous than this. Why do we so often hurt ourselves with that? We are all connected through this spiritual and emotional nervous system that runs throughout our entire body. Those nerves are connected to one another. And the more we become alert to and aware of how Satan tries to use that, well, until we do, we will be blind to how pain is inflicted. But we won't be impervious to the pain. The pains will be there. In the split sermon today, there's no way to cover all of these principles and concepts. I've really just begun to scratch a surface here. There are so many verses to study, but I hope it will stir us to a deep study. It's something that we need to give deep thought and deep analysis and some deep introspection to understand this tactic and this device of our adversary. We need to give not just thought, but study and prayer and fasting to this. A few weeks ago, during the pastoral training session, all of the ladies met together to discuss issues pertinent to being a minister's wife. And it was interesting. My wife told me later, you know what the major topic of conversation was? These are women from around the world, different places in the world, different congregations in the United States. And they said the major topic of conversation was the way we talk to and about each other. And they asked, could we have more? We need to talk about this. We need to talk about this issue because it affects the church. It affects everyone. And when you study the Word of God, it is addressed over and over again. Let's conclude in Ephesians 4 again. Pick up just past where we left off, Ephesians 4, verse 29. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. Man, that's hard, isn't it? But what is good? What is good for necessary edification or building up? He said, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but only what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. This requires God's Spirit at work. Verse 32, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ also forgave you. Having just come out of the Passover in the days of unleavened bread, we are probably more aware than perhaps other times of the year how it is we're standing here, sitting here due to the mercy and forgiveness and compassion of God our Father and Jesus Christ. They could have so much to accuse us of. So much. They know the reality, but they do not carry that spirit. The angels do not carry that spirit. The spirit of accusation is a powerful spirit. It's permeating society. And it's growing more and more. Maybe it's because the devil knows he has but a short time. But in the meantime, let's make sure we recognize it. Let's make sure we understand it. And guard our hearts and minds. And put it far from us. And just protect one another the way God protects us.